Welcome to Art Beat. I'm Chris Allen. On today's program, Minister Faust and his novel, The Coyote Kings of the Space Age Bachelor Pad.
Surrounded by 100 floating orange eyes. Now my mom can add, she knows 10 bullets don't down 50 coyotes, so it's looking freaking grim. A legion of coyotes in the moonlight. Now one coyote, huge, size of a wolf, pads up slowly. Got paws the size of hams, mouth like a row of razors, walks over, leans in, and sniffs right near my newborn body. My mom's mesmerized with terror, terrorized with mesmer, holding the gun, 49 coyotes and her, all of them, waiting to see what's going to happen. I capture Sharon's eyes, magnetizing her with my anecdotal powers. We're in the trench, near the exhaust port. I have her now. I keep waiting, pausing, until at last, yes, she bursts. The coyote leans in, I punch it, bares his teeth and nibbles. The umbilical cord through, neat as a surgeon, and backs off. And as one, all the coyotes lift their heads to the moon and howl like a voice out of the Ark of the Covenant. I lean back, sip my water, put the glass down. And right there, Mum knew a new king had been born. Me, the king of the coyotes.
Music from Hamza Eldin, whose namesake Hamza is one of the main characters in a book called The Coyote Kings of the Space Age Bachelor Pad, a portion of which you heard read by Edmonton author Minister Faust, also known as Malcolm Azenya. More from him in a moment, but first, my thanks to Jamie Freed for filling in for me while I was away. Minister Faust is a high school English teacher, a broadcaster, a community activist, writer, actor, and comic. He's run for political office and has produced and hosted award-winning radio shows of news and music, much of which he incorporates into his new novel, Hamza and Yehat, the Coyote Kings, as they call themselves, and others do as well, are best friends, brilliant but living simply as a dishwasher and video store clerk, respectively. Their work with children and their neighbors is rewarding emotionally, but in Hamza's case, it's leavened with the sadness of a lost love and an incapacity to move on. Into this world comes a mysterious and dangerous woman named Sarem, who speaks ancient African languages, loves the same obscure comics and sci-fi films the coyotes do, but is focused on finding an artifact with a fabled history. She is opposed by a pair of sinister but silky brothers and a vicious drug-dealing gang called the Fanboys, a name related to the comic book and sci-fi genre fans, and in essence to a pop culture that feeds into the mindset of most of the characters in the novel. Along with those references are nods to musicians, including Fela Anukalapo Kuti, Remy Ungala, and The Cars, in a sort of soundtrack to the characters' lives. Amid the pop culture, the music, and more erudite literary and artistic references are notes of religious derivations, reinterpretations of biblical and earlier stories, myths, and legends. Minister Faust outlined the background of the story.
Well, I mean, the genesis of the story is that in 1994, I wanted to make an independent movie. And I wrote a screenplay, and I brainstormed, you know, what's least expensive? Well, first of all, shooting in Edmonton, and all the most beautiful places of Edmonton and interesting places. And I love Edmonton. And I wanted to make Edmonton come alive mythically in a film. Not necessarily mythologically, but mythically, you know. And then I don't have the skills. I'm not a director. I'm not a filmmaker. But I wanted to write a novel, and I'd written two before, and I knew that this one, people loved the humor of the screenplay. And I thought, well, this would probably be my best shot in to begin a novelist career. And you know, I wanted to have a story like Walter Mosley, the writer of Socrates Fortlow and Easy Rollins. He says specifically he wants to talk about black male heroes, and it's great for anybody who grows up having heroes who look like them in books and movies knows the joy of that fascination, whether it's Odysseus or Indiana Jones or whatever. But if you're not presented with those images, there's a hole in your imagination, mm-hmm. and your psyche of identification. And I wanted to be able to create the fascination that I found growing up reading, whether it was Dune or Spider-Man or whatever else, but with characters who looked like me. And so I have one guy, he's a very intelligent young writer who's in a rut, and he's got no career, he washes dishes. And another guy who's a very intelligent, he's an engineer and he's an inventor, but he's in a rut and he's in a video store. And these are like guys that I knew. And then on the opposite side, there's another group of... And these are fanboys. They love science fiction, fantasy, comics, games, all that. On the opposite side is another group of fanboys who are also in ruts. But unfortunately, their way out of the rut is dealing the most deadly designer drug has ever been created. And
It's really basically straight out of comic book fandom with something like the Fantastic Four versus their nemesis, right?
It's true. I mean, in fact, my original title for the book was The Coyote Kings versus the Fanboys. And now she's standing, her fingers plunging towards her belt, then streaking upward. She spins toward the still staggering human torque, and when her whipping fingers rotate towards his neck, even in the darkness beneath distant streetlights, the plumes of blood, geysers more accurately, from the torque's throat are obvious. He moves one of his hands from his eyes, which seemed to be the source of his agony a moment ago, to clutch his throat. But blood gushes out despite his efforts. She front kicks him in the solar plexus and he drops, and she dances over him, raking him with her fingers again. When she lands, I can see two things clearly. One, that she is bleeding from her head, perhaps due to the initial impact of our fan van, and two, that each of her eight fingers is encased in a metallic cover like a long thimble, and from each radiates a 10-centimeter blade. The gesture to her belt, I understand now, arming herself with her jackal claws. Began combat less than 5 minutes ago, including the time it took to ram this woman's vehicle and roll her in it like a log down a hill. In that interval, the Mugatu, Captain Crunch, Vegemite, and the Human Torque have joined the ranks of Custer's men.
There's a feel of pop fandom. There are elements, in fact, even in some of the names. There's one called the Human Torque, which is obviously a riff on the Human Torch, which is one of the
Fantastic Four,
But there is also within it, as in the case of the characters, a good deal of depth of knowledge of various things. There's certainly a knowledge of the various parts of Africa that you deal with, Egypt, Ethiopia, some of the schism between Ethiopia and Eritrea.
Yes.
So some very serious matters being dealt with, as well as drugs and a few other things. Yeah. And I assume you wanted to explore that as well, not only in terms of having heroes that are of African heritage, but of perhaps dealing with some of the issues they have to deal with.
Yes. Well, exactly. And, you know, my feeling is that, science fiction and fantasy should be there's an element that is escapist and that lets us hopefully be filled with fascination and awe and wonder. But absolutely, unless fiction returns us to be dealing with the world in which we live and that forces us to ask big questions about our own psychology and that of the people around us, as well as our politics and our economics and our society, then that fiction is functioning only like a drug. It is only taking us away. And, an adult life is about engaging the world in which we live. And, you know, the other thing is that I don't think it's necessary to separate the fun and the whimsical and characters who talk about pop culture from these weighty matters, because I don't and you don't and everybody listening doesn't. I mean, we have multidimensional lives. And I think when you read fiction in which nobody listens to music, nobody makes a meal, nobody jokes around, you know, that very kind of weighty English department-y type of literature is very serious, very, very literary, you know, it's not honest.
It doesn't reveal necessarily the full kaleidoscope around our lives.
Mm-hmm.
There is in this an element. You refer to it in a somewhat offhand manner in the fact that you have to deal with your life in a serious manner with some humor. But one of the main characters in this, a woman of mystery, a very dangerous woman of mystery, Sherim.
Yes.
In fact, lectures Hamza, one of the main characters, on the dissipation of modern life and how people are really throwing their lives away on things. And that, to me, read like a little bit like Minister Faust thinking.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, hopefully it doesn't – I mean, for folks who may listen to my radio
show – It's not a polemic. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, for folks who may know me personally or know my work through my radio shows, you know, they may have that awareness and hopefully it doesn't throw them too much out of the prose and say, well, this is just the writer lecturing or hectoring me. I mean, I think all writers are, to a greater or lesser extent, the characters are them, you know. So whether it's their complaints or their silliness or whatever else. And, you know, hopefully you don't share the pathologies or the bigotries of your characters, but you understand irritation, so you apply that to a different issue. See, Hamza, it's just that. I like so much about you, and I can see all of the things you're capable of doing. I can see them. To me, they're as real as tomorrow's sunrise. They haven't happened yet, but they will. And I've seen too many people who didn't live out their dreams because they were caught up in pain, paying for someone else's mistakes, living in the chains of bitterness, crawling like butterflies with their wings torn off. And I don't want to see that happen to you, Hamza. Because I... Well, just because I don't.
More from Minister Faust about the Kairi Kings of the Space Age Bachelor Pad in a moment. This is music from Tariq Abubakar and the Afro-Nubians. You also heard Remy Ongala and Orchestra Super Matimila. You're listening to Artbeat on the CKUA Radio Network. I'm Chris Allen, here every Sunday afternoon at 12:30 and in rebroadcast Tuesday night at 8:30. Back now to Minister Faust and the Coyote Kings of the Space Age Bachelor Pad.
It's important to you, it seems, to mix, and this is a theme all the way through the book, the serious with the humorous and the joyful.
Yes.
One of the characters in this, though, does not and has a very hard time accepting that people can have those two lives. Sherim, who is the very dangerous, mysterious woman in this, has a heritage that goes back... Well, it might be, we won't say, but a very long time.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about her and her relation with these characters.
Yeah, well, you know, she, and I should say that a lot of the publicity around the book, you know, one of the phrases that's shown up in a lot of the publicity is that she's 7,000 years old. And I really want to clarify that she is not. She is a human being. Now, she may have things that make her somewhat superhuman, but she is... She was raised in Edmonton. She is a human being, and you know, she had a family that was, you know, we've all known people like this, whether it was religiously or politically or whatever, of people who were extremely devoted to a cause, and so devoted that it was really at the cost of their opportunity to have joy in their life. So fanatical about it that they would place their own lives at risk. And you know, there are people who I deeply admire because of their service to humanity, people like Ralph Nader, people like Malcolm X. But, you know, Ralph Nader chose not to have a family because he said it would be unfair to be an absentee father. Malcolm X had six children, but unfortunately, he was killed before two of them were even born.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can be devoted to a cause at the cost of the people who are closest to you. And so I didn't want to provide... simplistic either ors in this book. I wanted to show that, look, you know, if you care about doing what's right, it's not as simple as just saying, okay, I'll do what's right. You may find that you end up doing some wrong along the way.
What is right in this book?
Well, what's right in this book is compassion for other human beings. And the characters who have the least compassion
no matter how good their objectives are or if their objectives are bad, they all pay a very serious price. And the characters who are ultimately most compassionate, who want to try to solve things with the least amount of violence and hurt, or the ones who are most prepared to grow and most prepared to learn and move beyond their bigotries. And you know, Yihat, one of the two Coyote Kings, is he's somewhat homophobic. And one of his, you know, part of his character arc is to let go of some of that. And, you know, there's another character, one of the fanboys named Frosty, whose brother was killed by gay bashers. And this is something that, you know, the pain, seeing somebody who he loves murdered and then him being a person who's pushed around, unfortunately, he makes the wrong decision. Mm-hmm. He decides nobody will ever hurt him again, so he becomes a horrible person. And so that's really what this is about. It's about compassion.
And, in fact, his boss, who is one of the worst of the worst,
yes.
In fact, has his moments of pain and suffering from whence we see that there may be a line to where he's become
exactly.
This hard, nasty man.
Yes. And, you know, I think that when writers present characters that offer us no opportunity for compassion, it's really they're depriving us of an opportunity to grow in our own humanity, because no matter how much you are angry at somebody who may have wronged you terribly, you have to recognize that some part of that person is in pain, and on some level you have to be able to try to accept that this person doesn't want to do harm. They actually think they're doing good.
Third generation glacier, she says. Make it fourth generation, distill it down. And it's the ultimate hallucinogenic and mind control drug. 1,000 times more powerful than LSD, called cream. Users say it's the closest human beings get to telepathy. Magnifies the senses like a nuclear reactor, so for artists, for sex, for people who like to induce pain, or to kill. My legs lose their strength, and she catches me, guides me back to the mat, sits in front of me, her hands on the blankets above my knees. There's a global network of covens, cults, companies, all trying to produce trackers with chemically induced powers to match your naturally occurring ones. Artificial Sechtencha. Street crack was phase one. The most depraved addicts are routinely disappeared. Who miss them?
Everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come. Hammy, they come. Confusion everywhere.
You mentioned within the course of our conversation music. And music is a through line that runs all the way in this book. And wonderful music, some exceptional masters of music throughout this. I wondered if while you were writing it, you had some of them on.
Absolutely. And in fact, this was the third novel manuscript that I'd written. And when I write, I not only constantly play music, but the genesis often of a book is that I start to think of what songs suggest certain moods or events. And so I compile a soundtrack, you know, and sometimes it's just one CD and sometimes it ends up being three or four.
One of them for whence this person is named, Hamza Eldin, is a part of this,
yes.
A brilliant performer.
Yes.
But it seems to me, I can almost hear a rhythm of music in this book.
Yes,
it runs and flows to certain rhythms. The fight scenes, for instance, I can hear certain music. The love scenes, other music. And I wonder how serious you got about it, for instance, when you sat down at your, computer?
Yes, yeah.
Did you pick a particular track of music for a particular scene, or was it that serious?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, because it started as a screenplay, I had selected music, and you know, I realized that we might not acquire the rights, but at least you aim for what you want, you know. So I had very specific songs chosen, and as much as possible, I tried, because it is in some level it's an Afrocentric book. I wanted to try to expose readers to a variety of continental African artists, as well as some North American Africans. And, I mean, one of the songs is by Tariq Abubakar, who's a Sudanese, who became a Canadian, sadly passed away a few years ago in a traffic accident. But, you know, if I'm writing, a tender scene. I cannot be listening to Fight the Power by Public Enemy.
Or Shabba Ranks or...
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Exactly, you know. So, you know, you need music that is suggestive of what your characters are experiencing. Mm. And, I mean, it would be a thrill for me, and I would love it if this could be re-released with a CD. But at the very least, I'm going to put on my website all the songs in order. And if people want to, you know, with proper copyright, you know, go out, buy the records, and make their own soundtrack. That'd be great.
Seems to me that it would have been a nice idea to have that at the back of the book, maybe in the next printing.
That's a very good call. I think I'd like to do that.
You mentioned you wrote this, or at least began it, in 1994. And there are a few anachronistic references in here, like, for instance, the rat hole, which is the tunnel that went under the now non-existent train tracks.
That's right.
On 109th Street in Edmonton. Yeah. And you talk about Babylon 5 versus Deep Space Nine, both of which were very popular around that time.
Yes.
Do you see any problem with that for a modern reader listening to it? Can you read it in the sense of maybe it happened 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, people live in real time, you know, and when you're in school, you know, your teacher might talk about how, oh, this protagonist is never named so that everybody can identify with him. It doesn't work that way. You don't identify with somebody who doesn't have a name.
Hmm.
You know, a well-told story, you know, means that you identify with this person on the basis of their specificity, not their supposed universality or their basic blankness. So these characters live in real time, and they refer to albums just coming out, TV shows, landmarks. And I think that as long as the story is emotionally true, those things not only don't throw people out of it, people enjoy those details. Now, a non-Edmontonian, it doesn't matter.
There is something as well about this that we haven't mentioned, and that is at the outset of every chapter with a new character, a description of them which reads a bit like the kind of thing you would see on a video game.
Or specifically role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons.
Right.
Yes.
So there's a list of their various attributes, their deficiencies, their sense.
Colon capacity.
What prompted that? Is it just a...
Well, I mean, you know, especially when it's a screenplay. I mean, I had to always be thinking of what's visually grabbing, what's unusual, what have we never seen before? And then one of the real delights about writing a screenplay first and turning it into a book is that you've got things that are very non-book-like. So you could simply scrap them, or you could say, how do I make this into a book? And because of that, a number of my stage directions I incorporated as narration, but they don't work as standard narration. So my character had to have a good reason for saying such a strange thing, and that made me come up with something unusual. Mm. And so these character data sheets, I thought they'd be on screen, and you know, you'd read one or two details and it would be over. But I got to go into much greater detail in the book, and it's like Dungeons and Dragons.
Let's read one of them.
Sure,
part of it anyway.
Sure, absolutely.
You pick it. I don't care.
Sure. Well, I'll choose. Assuming I can find it quickly enough. One of my characters is named Zenko. And he's sort of like the Tony Robbins of drugs. So I won't read all the details. But
he's the man that set up the networks and is a very capable individual.
Exactly. So, okay, character data. Darwin M. Zenko. Real name, Darwin N. Zenko. Cunning, situational politics plus 13. Education, a BCom with distinction working on MBA. Eats at Shabba Dabba Doo's on Jasper, Earl's Tin Palace, Red Robin, Joey Tomatoes, Eddie Bauer Espresso, Gap Pasticcino. I'll skip down a bit. Mother, psychiatrist. Father, psychiatrist. Clearly then, siblings, A, became addicts, and or B, joined cults, and or C, entered rehab, and therefore D, became psychotherapists. So these are some of the, you know.
And what it does, in a sense, is it gives us a précis of a character just by simply saying, well, he eats at these Tony, either pop culture places like Joey Tomatoes or Gap Cappuccino.
Yes.
And he's not exactly the most cultured
individual. No, in fact, he refers to, he comes into a nightclub that his boss owns, and the song is... playing by the Cars, you know, a fine white 80s pop group. And he complains that the Cars are too jungle bunny for him.
You
know, so he's not very sophisticated. You know? Let the good times roll. Won't you let the good times roll.
You said earlier that you have a deep love of Edmonton, and I think it shows in this book because you lovingly describe certain areas, even in their shabbiness, some of them.
Yeah.
You describe an area you call Coosh, which of course refers to southern, the southern
like the horn
portion
of
below Egypt.
Yes.
But it also refers to, in this case, a district which is north of the Saskatchewan River and just north of the center of town.
Right, yes.
Is that a real neighborhood?
Well, it's basically 107th Avenue between about 101st Street and 109th Street. And, it's a multicultural area like most of Edmonton. And Edmonton doesn't really have these sort of ethnically unicultural areas. But there are a lot of the city's Ethiopians, Sudanese, Eritreans, and Ethiopians who live in that area. And for a while, there were about four Ethiopian restaurants on 107th Avenue or one or two blocks off. And so there's a lot of that there. And there are a few stores. There are some West Africans there as well. But so it's really, it's becoming a very interesting continental African neighborhood. Now, I don't know whether that will be sustained, but I wanted to give it some mythic dimensions right now.
See, this is purely for my own benefit because the restaurant you described, the Ethiopian restaurant, is something that just I was drooling.
We all love eating, and yet eating and food, you very rarely read about it in a book. And on radio, it's hard to find somebody to fall in love with. But every day, you eat. So why aren't there more songs about food,
Minister Faust, as this is being recorded, a new Ethiopian restaurant has just opened in the old Strathcona area of Edmonton, which is one of the environs Minister Faust and his characters inhabit, life in part imitating art. You heard music from Hamza Eldin, Tariq Abubakar, Fela Enikalapo Kuti, Remy Ongala, and The Cars. The Coyote Kings of the Space Age Bachelor Pad is $22.95 trade paperback from Del Rey Ballantyne Books. We're coming to the end of our program, but just a reminder, let us know if you have an event, CD or book release or other artistic endeavor coming up. You can email us at arts@ckua.org. Our fax number is area code 780-428-7624 in Edmonton. Or phone Jamie Freet, CKUA's Southern Region Arts Correspondent at 403-262-3641, fax 262-3645, or email artsouth@ckua.org. If you'd like information on arts events across the province, check our website at ckua.com and click on events. And that's it for this edition of ArtBeats. Thanks to Minister Faust. Our technical producer is Andrew Ceresic, and ArtBeat is written and produced by me, Chris Allen. Join me again next Sunday afternoon at 12:30 and in rebroadcast Tuesday night at 8:30 for ArtBeat.